You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey, folks. Got big plans for the new year? Maybe you're ready to finally launch a small business, start a blog, or promote your favorite passion project. Well, in this day and age, it doesn't exist if it doesn't have a good-looking professional web presence. Luckily, Squarespace makes it easy to turn your idea into a unique website. Showcase your work, publish content, even sell products and services of all kinds in just a few clicks. You can customize everything from the look and feel to settings and products using beautiful templates created by world-class designers. And there's nothing to install, patch, or upgrade ever. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code KICK to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Again, that's squarespace.com and offer code KICK for 10% off. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. My guest today needs no introduction. One of the most effective military leaders in recent U.S. history, General David Petraeus, is a highly decorated four-star general whose distinguished military career spanned over 37 years and culminated in six straight commands, five of which were in combat. Widely credited for changing the course of two wars by dramatically reducing the violence in Iraq when he led the so-called surge, and later by halting the Taliban's momentum in Afghanistan, Petraeus was also instrumental in reshaping American military doctrine and then implementing it when he led the conduct of comprehensive civil-military counterinsurgency campaigns. Serving in multiple campaigns, including nearly 7 years deployed following 9/11, Petraeus has been described as one of the great battle captains of American history. His command during many years in combat has resulted in comparisons to Ulysses S. Grant, John J. Pershing, George C. Marshall, and Dwight D. Eisenhower. Following his military service, Petraeus led the CIA, where he oversaw significant achievements in America's global counterterrorism campaign, pursued a substantial initiative to increase worldwide intelligence coverage, and guided the development of a strategic plan for the agency. Now working in the private sector, Petraeus is currently chairman of the KKR Global Institute and remains heavily involved with over a dozen veteran service organizations. On today's podcast, he sits down with me to discuss the fundamentals of counterinsurgency, the paradox of nation building, and how a grad school dissertation on the Vietnam War helped shape his worldview. He talks about implementing the successful surge strategy in Iraq, what later went wrong there, and some of the unique problems he encountered in Afghanistan. Plus, he weighs in on the recent resurgence of large geopolitical rivalries, his personal disdain for yes men, and whether the current commander-in-chief is getting the unvarnished truth from his own generals. Coming up with General David Petraeus in just a moment. During his 37 years in the U.S. military, retired four-star general David Petraeus served as commander of the 101st Airborne and then commanding general of the multinational force in Iraq. After that, he served as commander of United States Central Command, commander of U.S. forces in the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan, before retiring from the military to become director of the Central Intelligence Agency. He is considered the foremost expert on counterinsurgency and the father of the successful surge strategy in Iraq, and today he's sitting down with me at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and Museum. General David Petraeus, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Good to be with you, Ben. Thanks.
When you were in school, you did your doctoral dissertation, and it was titled The American Military and the Lessons of Vietnam, a Study of Military Influence and the Use of Force in the Post-Vietnam Era. What kind of conclusions did you reach about that war then, and how it would influence U.S. military strategy in the decades that followed?
Well, it's interesting because, of course, the lessons of Vietnam were greatly fought over, if you will, by a variety of different scholars and practitioners and participants. And you had people that took from it no more Vietnams as a fairly general concept, no more ground wars on Asian soil, never again in these kind of murky counterinsurgency situations. In fact, even shouldn't have the capability or the knowledge and practice for conducting counterinsurgency operations. And I drew somewhat different conclusions. I actually came away from that recognizing, to be sure, the extraordinary challenges of fighting on that soil in those circumstances in support of leaders who were, to a degree, out of touch with their own people. Again, spoke a different language, a different religion, and saw themselves as an elite rather than the peasants who were out in the villages and so on. But having said all that, I came away from that thinking that we very likely would be engaged in such a conflict again, where we would not just be doing offensive and defensive operations, but also stability operations. And it's the combination of those three, of course, that distinguishes a counterinsurgency campaign from, say, a major combat operations campaign such as Desert Storm. And I thought, therefore, we probably ought to have both the intellectual concepts and some military capabilities for the conduct of such operations. Beyond that, I also took from that lessons that would later inform the way that I offered advice to the president and the national security team on the use of force. So when I was working for President Bush or for President Obama as the commander in Iraq or at U.S. Central Command or in Afghanistan, I told each of them, in fact, that if they hired me, what they were going to get was a military commander who would provide options and a recommendation that would be based on the mission as we understood it, and we'd have dialogue on that and the tasks that fall out from that, and the facts on the ground, informed by an awareness of all of the other issues that a president understandably has to be concerned with, such as domestic politics, congressional politics, budget deficits, strain on the force, coalition politics, you name it. But driven, again, by the facts on the ground. And so at a later period, in fact, during the discussion on the drawdown pace in Afghanistan, at the end of three meetings that covered about a week's period of time, I came back to Washington from Afghanistan to do that. When I was asked if I supported the president's decision, I said, of course I support the president's decision, but my recommendation is unchanged because the facts on the ground have not changed during the course of our deliberations on this subject. And that was a somewhat awkward and uncomfortable moment, but I felt that that's what I owed to the president, to the American people, and above all to our men and women on the ground in that country.
Going back to your early years, you're a military commander who comes to this with a unique perspective because you went to the Woodrow Wilson School of Public Policy at Princeton, where you got a PhD in international relations and economics. How did that background inform your decisions as a military commander?
Well, it was very, very helpful. It, on one hand, gave me a degree of intellectual humility, frankly. I realize there's some seriously bright people in the world who don't see it in the same through the same prism that I do. It and that helped as I dealt with foreign cultures, people of different faiths, ethnic groups, and all the rest. It gave, frankly, an ability to, I think, analyze better, to communicate better in writing and orally as well. There were actually programs to promote each of those at the Woodrow Wilson School. It gave an understanding of the concepts of political philosophy and economics, which might seem odd that as being something that I would hold as valuable. But, you know, in the first year in Iraq, the division commanders on the ground were occupation force commanders by the Geneva Convention. And we therefore were responsible for everything that happened in those areas that were within our responsibility. And I used those repeatedly, simple concepts such as minority rights as well as majority rule, basic concepts of free market economics and so forth proved very, very valuable. And they were also, these were academic sources of academic expertise that were then further built on by practical experience in tours in Central America, a short tour there as a special assistant for the Commander-in-Chief of U.S. Southern Command, then a tour as the Chief of Operations for the United Nations Force when it took over from the U.S.-led Joint Task Force in Kuwait for a period of time as a one-star, and then in Bosnia for a year as a one-star, where we were not just doing the NATO peacekeeping, but I also had a hat as the deputy commander of a U.S. Joint Task Force that was doing the war criminal hunt and also then counterterrorism operations in the wake of 9/11. So when you put all of that together, and then also, frankly, just my sheer curiosity and interest in the history of, say, the French in Indochina, of course, the U.S. in Vietnam, the British in Malaya and in Oman, a variety of these irregular wars that were so intriguing to me. And I'd like to think that that did help and provide the intellectual foundation that did help us as we were developing our campaign plan in the 101st Airborne Division area after the fight to Baghdad at a time when we got very, very little guidance.
Well, when you were commander of the 101st Airborne in Mosul, you were able to put a lot of these ideas into practice. Mosul has been, of course, famously problematic, but it experienced a period of relative calm while you were there. In achieving that relative peace in Mosul, talk about some of the programs that you implemented that helped balance that carrot and stick approach to counterinsurgency. Maybe the programs that weren't necessarily acts of force, but some of what you were talking about from the economic and international relations perspective.
Well, we set about right away. I devoted the entire first 2 weeks on the ground in Mosul after we completely blanketed the city, a city that was totally out of control and in which a very small U.S. contingent brought off a ship in the Mediterranean had been incapable of dealing with the violence and the looting and all the other challenges, and in fact had been confronted by Iraqis, and which resulted in the deaths of 17 Iraqi civilians, which led to the order for the 101st to unexpectedly deploy very rapidly north and to establish security in Mosul and then in the greater Nainua province, for which Mosul is the capital. So the first 2 weeks I devoted completely to getting Iraqi partners. I realized that we knew nothing about Nainua. There were no State Department officials or CIA or anybody else who knew anything of any detail about Nainua province. Some of them had been north of the Green Line up in the Kurdish regional government, but that didn't translate into effective and helpful knowledge of the context, which we found in this most diverse of all provinces in Iraq, Sunni Arab majority, but also Shia Arab minority, Kurds, Yazidis, Shabak, Turkmen, Christians. It just was an extraordinary location, and it had both one of Iraq's great universities and numerous tribes out in the desert. And you had to cobble all this together. So we spent 2 weeks from dawn till dusk. All I did was meet with Iraqis, gain an understanding of these different elements in society, and then cobble together what I thought would be a representative provincial council, and then structure a caucus election that would result in that provincial council.
Not an easy task.
It was very, very challenging. And, of course, the Iraqis, you know, were all born in the souk, and they would come in each morning and want to renegotiate what we'd agreed to in the previous 24 hours until finally I realized that I had to do some acting just as they did. And toward the end of that process, they came in and said, oh, by the way, we had to go back to our tribes and they're under pressure to renegotiate. And I slammed my fist on the table and said, that's it. I will not renegotiate. I will not. And they all were so intimidated that and I was, you know, very clear about who the sheikh of the strongest tribe in northern Iraq was. And it was obviously the commander of the Screaming Eagles, the 101st Airborne, which had some 250 helicopters alone, in addition to an infantry division's worth of air assault troopers, et cetera, et cetera. But beyond that, then we set about right away, once we had these leaders, we set about improving the circumstances of the people, reestablishing basic services. We took what we'd done in Bosnia, where you had what was called the multi-year roadmap with all of the different functions identified that were needed. But in Bosnia, you had the UN mission to do the policing, and you had the high rep to do the political, and you had the all these different other organizations to do all the civilian tasks. Here we had to perform them all ourselves. So we aligned logical units where we had them. For example, we had a field hospital, so we aligned that organization with helping to reestablish the civilian hospital in Mosul. We aligned a signal battalion with the Ministry of Communications and even brought in a satellite shot truck that could enable international calls, the only place in Iraq that had it. And by the way, we were making money with it for the Iraqi government. We reopened the border with Syria on our own, but in accordance with the UN Security Council regulations governing trade with Iraq. And after informing my higher headquarters, although unfortunately that didn't get all the way to the State Department, and Secretary of State Powell later accused me of having our own foreign policy. But beyond that, so every single ministry activity had a counterpart in our organization responsible for helping to reestablish that ministry activity and its functions. And in fact, I had one as well, and I had a team deployed to support me. I was the mentor to the governor of the province, and he and I worked closely together. Beyond that, when the twin catastrophic decisions that set back progress so dramatically in most of Iraq were made, this was firing the military without telling them what their future was for five very tough, hard weeks of bigger and bigger demonstrations, and then firing the Ba'ath Party all the way down to level four, which included tens of thousands of Iraqi bureaucrats, many of whom we needed to run that country. And by the way, in the case of Mosul University, for example, had somewhere around 110 or 120 tenured faculty members were all level four, that lowest level, but was excluded from society now, basically thrown out of everything that they had, not just their job, but their station in life, their house, their car, their very reason for existence, with no prospect for employment anywhere in Iraq, because it's only the government that ran the different entities and organizations that could hire those individuals. And so we got special dispensation from Ambassador Bremer to run a reconciliation process in Nainoa province. And it prolonged the era of good feeling. First, it reestablished it. It gave hope to the Iraqis who had been cast out from what it was they were doing. And again, keep in mind, these are individuals, many of whom were educated in the West. They were, as we used to say, our kind of people, our kind of Iraqis. They actually drank, some of them. I mean, we didn't want a bunch of Islamists coming in and taking over all these organizations, which is what ultimately tragically happened, because some 6 months later, we were never able to get the Iraqi government to underwrite and support the decisions, the recommendations that we made on reconciliation. But having a de-Ba'athification process without an agreed reconciliation process, which is what was done in Baghdad by the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, was a catastrophically bad decision and a huge setback. Again, we were able to come back from that, to recover a fair amount from that, Because at the end of the day, you constantly have to be asking yourself, will this operation or this policy take more bad guys off the streets than it creates by its implementation or conduct? Mm-hmm. And if the answer to that question is no, then you should go sit under a tree until the thought passes. And that's what we should have done with respect to firing the military without telling them their future, mm-hmm. and firing the Ba'ath Party within an agreed reconciliation process. But again, we were able to recover a good bit from that and to produce a brighter future for a period of time, the prospect of that for the Iraqis of Nainoa province, even as we, by the way, continued relentless pursuit of the very senior members of the Ba'ath Party, including Uday and Qusay, Saddam's sons, whom we killed in Mosul, mm-hmm. in an operation in July of that year.
Is this what you mean when you say that a leader's most important task is to set the right tone?
Well, it is part of that. I think actually the strategic leader's most important task is to get the big ideas right, to get mm-hmm. the strategy right. And if you think about the surge in Iraq, the surge that mattered most was not the surge of 25 or 30,000 additional forces added to a force that was almost 140,000 U.S. to begin with. It was the surge of ideas and the implementation of a strategy that was literally 180 degrees different in every key respect over what we were doing in 2006, mm-hmm. Which the then commander assessed very objectively and frankly and forthrightly to be failing to achieve the desired objectives. So it's about getting the big ideas right. It's communicating them effectively through the breadth and depth of the organization. It's overseeing their implementation. And then there's a step that we sometimes forget, which is to have a formal process to identify how the big ideas, the strategy, need to be revised, mm-hmm. changed, adjusted in response to developments on the battlefield. Now, one of those tasks of that leader very much is to establish the right tone. And that tone is one that is expressed generally in the mission statement, the campaign plan, the communications of the commander to the troops, you know, the letter I sent on the first day, the meeting with the commanders, the importance, for example, of being seen to support and to secure the people of Iraq, that the most important terrain in Iraq was the human terrain, not the physical terrain, and that we had to secure that because without that, we would be building everything else on a shaky foundation. And again, how do we deal with our Iraqi host nation counterparts? How do we deal with our coalition counterparts? What is the character of that, if you will? Again, what is the tone of that? And I think that is crucial. We set about early on as commander of the 101st that we were going to try to have a positive, the kind of relationship with the people that was productive, that respected them and their respective ethnic and sectarian and tribal groupings. And that is crucially important because if you do not do that, the people inevitably will find reasons to oppose you rather than to support you.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with General David Petraeus when we come back in just a minute. Folks, have you tried to hire someone lately? It's hard. Believe me, as a small business owner, I know. In my experience, you're either casting a wide net and wasting a lot of time sifting through unqualified applicants, or you rely on word of mouth through friends and business associates. But what are the odds that you're going to catch the right candidate at the right moment when they're actually available and looking to make a move? You can post to job boards and hope you'll find the right person for your job, but think about it. How often do you check job boards? For most people, probably not often. But there is a place where people go daily to grow professionally and explore job opportunities. In fact, 70% of the U.S. workforce is there. LinkedIn. You already know LinkedIn is the world's largest professional network. Well, it's also a better way to find great talent. Just ask any of the hundreds of thousands of businesses who've posted to LinkedIn Jobs over the past year. In fact, 22 million professionals view and apply for jobs on LinkedIn every week. And because LinkedIn considers skills, experience, location, and more to match and promote your job to potential candidates, businesses rate LinkedIn Jobs 40% higher than job boards at delivering quality candidates.
A business is only as strong as its people, and every hire matters. So don't settle for posting and hoping the right person will find your role and apply. Go to linkedin.com/kickass and get a $50 credit toward your first job post. That's linkedin.com/kickass for your $50 credit today. Terms and conditions apply. The Art of Charm is an iTunes Top 50 podcast that's packed with wisdom in the truest sense of the word. From how to become more productive and professional to how to read body language, network, and negotiate, the show basically covers anything that will help you become a high performer at home and at work. And with a powerful armory of weapons like influence and persuasion, it brings together interesting people like Shaq, Russell Brand, Larry King, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and Bill Nye to discuss relationships, attraction, life hacking, and success. The Art of Charm is highly addictive and strives to be fun and educational at the same time. It's not stuffy college professor textbook stuff. Personal growth shouldn't be so boring all the time. This isn't pop psychology and superficial advice. This is a show that offers meaningful, fun, life-changing insights with a practical edge that you can apply right out of the box. You deserve an extraordinary life, so go to theartofcharm.com/podcast or search for The Art of Charm on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and start taking your life to the next level. I really enjoy this show, and I think you will as well. A lot of what you're talking about right now is the kind of quote-unquote nation building that periodically American politicians run from. President Trump and nationalists like Steve Bannon have more recently eschewed nation building. How do you feel about that? Isn't that responsibility the cost of war? Sort of, you broke it, you bought it.
The reality is we face a paradox, if you will. Mm-hmm. And that paradox is that you cannot kill or capture your way out of an industrial strength insurgency. You cannot counter terrorists like Al-Qaeda in Iraq and their associated Sunni insurgents, or more recently ISIS and Al-Qaeda, with just counter-terrorist force operations. In other words, you can't drone strike or Delta Force raid your, or even conventional force raid your way out of these problems. You have to have a comprehensive civil military campaign. Now, I am very sensitive to the imperative that these campaigns be sustainable. And sustainability is measured in blood and treasure. And that has to be sustainable because we realize now, I think, very clearly that we are engaged in a generational struggle, not just the fight of a decade or a few years. Mm-hmm. We will make progress. We have, obviously. We essentially have defeated the Islamic State that is an army that was on the ground in Iraq and in Syria, although we should be very clear, there will still be terrorist cells, there will be residual insurgents, guerrillas, et cetera. And what determines whether or not this there are fertile fields for the planting of the seeds of ISIS 3.0 will be these other activities. It will be politics. Are these politics inclusive? Do they give the Sunni Arabs of Iraq incentives to support the new Iraq or, frankly, incentives to oppose it, as was the case prior to the surge in 2006, which we then embarked on the surge in February of 2007. And again, when Prime Minister Maliki, after the departure of U.S. combat forces, pursued a ruinous policy of highly sectarian activities that went after the senior Sunni Arab leaders in the Iraqi government with legal charges and so forth, and then violently put down peaceful Sunni Arab demonstrations and created a sense again of this among the Sunni community that they should oppose the new Iraq or its government at the very least rather than support it. And that, of course, also allowed the resurrection of Al-Qaeda in Iraq as ISIS and all that followed as ISIS went into the Syrian civil war and gained such additional capabilities in terms of forces, leaders, money, explosives, vehicles, weapon systems, and so forth and so on. So again, you have to conduct a comprehensive campaign. That is inescapable. You cannot succeed. You can't make progress if you do not conduct that. But I'm very sensitive to the fact that we want host nation forces, coalition partners, and others doing as much as is possible so that we can keep the cost of this to a level that is, again, sustainable. And frankly, I think that we have done that in Iraq and in Syria. And it started with the previous administration, which, however reluctant it may have been to return forces to Iraq, having pulled them out at the end of 2011, and then to intervene also in Syria in support of the opposition forces that were willing to combat the Islamic State, they did forge an approach that this administration then built on effectively and has accelerated the defeat of the Islamic State and provided a model that we are employing in other locations as well, such as Somalia, North Africa, West Africa, Afghanistan, and a variety of other places around the world as far east as the Philippines.
You famously said at one point that you didn't think the term victory would be appropriate in the case of the Iraq War, saying that it's not the sort of war where you take a hill, plant a flag, and go home. If that's the case and counterinsurgency is the future of conflict, is it just a situation where we're doomed to play a never-ending game of whack-a-mole to a greater or lesser extent?
Well, first of all, I would note that counterinsurgency is not the future of conflict. Mm-hmm. It is certainly the future of many of the conflicts in which we will engage. But we clearly need increasingly, in fact, given the resurgence of Russia, the rise of China, developments in North Korea, the ambitions of Iran and so forth, to be ready to conduct high-end combat with near-peer forces. Having said that, clearly we have to make progress in those campaigns in which we're engaged. And the reason I've stressed that this is not Desert Storm, again, an operation which you take the hill, a mission, you take the hill, plant the flag, and go home to a victory parade, is to have people understand once again, as I mentioned earlier, that this is a generational struggle. It's not the battle of a decade or much less a few years, and we're going to be at it for a long period of time. We want to have a sustainable strategy, which I believe we are in the process of developing and refining. But nonetheless, this is going to continue. We may be able to make the kind of progress that we have seen in Iraq and in Syria and thereby draw down our forces, but not go home. We need to stay engaged. And in fact, in Iraq now, I would contend that we're now seeing what I have always termed the most important battle being waged, and that is the battle after the battle. I really never doubted that with our advice, assistance, training, and equipping, and above all, enabling by the U.S. and coalition forces of Iraqi security forces, that we could reconstitute them, resurrect them, and then help them to defeat the Islamic State. I was very confident that would be the case. It certainly took more than a couple of years, but it proved doable. The battle that's actually tougher, the battle after the battle, is the struggle for power and resources in a country that has many ethnic, sectarian, tribal, and political centrifugal forces pulling it apart, but also some important centripetal forces, one of which is certainly the central government's distribution of oil revenues, which are very substantial and gives Iraq a real leg up over, say, a country like Afghanistan, which can barely get 1% of the kind of revenue that Iraq can generate.
Would you say that that was one of the key differences in terms of the difficulties in dealing with Iraq versus Afghanistan?
Well, there were many difficulties, many differences between Afghanistan and Iraq. And in fact, interestingly, after the tour in Iraq, 15 and a half months, as the three-star commander of the train and equip mission, the so-called Multinational Transition Command Iraq, and also NATO training mission in Iraq, Secretary Rumsfeld asked me to come home through Afghanistan, and his way of rewarding you, I guess, for a job somewhat well done, and to do an assessment there. And so we dutifully did that. A team and I went over there, spent a week or more there, and then came home. And the very first slide that I showed him in the presentation after returning was titled, "Afghanistan Does Not Equal Iraq." And it laid out all the different areas by which you might compare those two countries. And certainly the inability to generate revenue was a huge difference for Afghanistan compared to Iraq. But the bigger difference, frankly, was the fact that the insurgent groups and terrorist groups that were plaguing Afghanistan and seeking to undo what it was that we had helped Afghans achieve had their headquarters and their leaders outside the country in sanctuaries in Pakistan, down in Balochistan, in the case of the Afghan Taliban, around Quetta, and then in North Waziristan in the federally administered tribal areas in the mountainous western part of Pakistan, where you found the Haqqani network, the Haqqani Taliban, as they're sometimes referred to, Al-Qaeda, the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, and others. That's where their leaders and headquarters and training bases and so forth were all located. That created enormous difficulties because you certainly want to reconcile or reintegrate, as we use the term, in Afghanistan with the rank and file. But at the same time, you also want to relentlessly pursue the irreconcilables. And these are the senior leaders. And if they are out of your grasp because they don't come into the country, you have a significant challenge on your hands. Beyond that, there were a number of other. The illiteracy rate in Afghanistan vastly higher, to the point we actually had to have basic skills education programs in the basic training for the Afghan soldiers so that they could actually read the license plate number that might be on a BOLO list, be on the lookout list.
Yeah.
The lack of infrastructure, the lack of understanding of central government, the lack of human capital, all of these. And then, by the way, the terrain, we might say again that the human terrain is a decisive terrain. Well, Afghanistan also has some very serious geographic terrain in the form of the Hindu Kush Mountains, vast hot deserts, and all the rest.
Yeah. Now, looking back, do you see actions that could have or should have been taken in Iraq and Afghanistan that might have prevented or at the very least blunted the rise of ISIS in the region?
Certainly. Sure. Mm-hmm. If we had, and no guarantees, but if we'd been able to keep our forces in Iraq, at the very least, one of the intentions of that, and keep in mind I was the director of the CIA at that time, right, was to help our Iraqi counterparts and the counterterrorism service and the intelligence services to keep Al-Qaeda in Iraq down, keep them defeated, destroyed, really. They were on their stomach, if you will. Mm-hmm. And instead, when our forces pulled out and Prime Minister Maliki didn't allow us to provide some of the assistance that he had actually requested earlier and then did not follow through in allowing to deploy, Al-Qaeda in Iraq was not targeted as relentlessly as needed to be to keep them down. They were able to get back up on their knees, then on their feet. And then, of course, the Sunni Arab part of the country became more receptive to them once again because they saw the government in Iraq pursuing highly sectarian policies, targeting them rather than trying to keep them inside the fold and reneging on the agreements that were made during the reconciliation process, during the Anbar Awakening and the Sahwa, as it was called, particularly with respect to the Sons of Iraq, these individuals who are part of insurgent groups or Shia militia elements as well, that then ended up reconciling with the government and being taken care of in some fashion, a fairly inexpensive fashion, I might add, compared with the cost of having to pursue combat operations against them.
Depending on who advisors are serving, there can be a tendency on their part to sugarcoat the truth or give a commander only the news they want to hear. Along those lines, many of the people who've worked under you have praised your respect for bluntness and realism, saying that you always wanted the straight truth, no matter how ugly it was. Do you think the current president is getting the straight, unvarnished facts from his military advisors?
I generally do, certainly those who are in the national security team. And keep in mind that one member of that team is Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, whose doctoral dissertation was published as a book with the title Dereliction of Duty, which was his characterization of the performance of the chiefs of staff, the joint chiefs, and frankly also of the president and his national security team during the Johnson administration. And I tried very, very hard, not just in dealing with the press, but in dealing with our own leaders, to be first with the truth. In fact, that was the goal I established for our public affairs officer. I said, we're not going to put lipstick on pigs. If there's a tough day, our job is to go out to the microphone, to the press, to the leaders, and state that and talk about what happened and identify the lessons that we should learn from this together with our Iraqi and coalition partners, and then discuss the steps that we will take to mitigate the chances of similar terrible attacks or mistakes or whatever being made. So I felt that very strongly. And it's interesting because, in fact, one of my big mentors who came out with us many times, one of the very few retired four-stars who recommended surge rather than withdrawal or more special operations or training and equipping, is General Jack Keane, who's also out here at the Reagan Library for this conference. He came out multiple times. He was a big mentor of mine, a former boss of mine. And he was retired, but we still brought him out. And he was another set of eyes for me, another set of another source of great reasoned input, having been watching this for a number of years since the very beginning when he was the vice chief and then the acting chief of staff of the Army. And at one point, I remember several months into the surge, he said, you know, you've got a public relations problem here because the results are starting to improve, but no one recognizes this yet. And I said, sir, really what we have is still a results problem. And when the results are demonstrably better for a sustained period of time, mm-hmm. our public relations problem will go away. And I am not going to be the one that is trying to get ahead of what the press, the people, our troops recognize is happening on the ground. And in fact, that's what happened when all of a sudden, by the time Ambassador Crocker and I went back for the six-month testimony to the houses of Congress for both the Armed Services and Foreign Relations Committees, we had 8 of the previous 11 weeks with significant downturns in the levels of violence. This was statistically significant. It wasn't just it was a true development, not just a short trend. And indeed, the public relations problem started to go away as even those who frankly had criticized or opposed the surge came to recognize that it was actually succeeding.
You've been in the private sector for a few years now. How's that adjustment been for you?
It's been wonderful, frankly. I've been very, very fortunate in my post-government life. We're over 5 years now. I have been with KKR for over 4.5 years. This is one of the largest investment firms in the world, well over $150 billion under management. And I was made a partner 3.5 years ago. I chair the KKR Global Institute, which does the geopolitical risk, macroeconomic, and environmental social governance issues analysis for our prospective deals, helps the 150-plus companies in which we're invested around the world, and also provides a lot of support to our investors who are all trying to understand the world in which we're investing as well. I have academic affiliations with the University of Southern California, Go Trojans, who won the Pac-12 championship last night against Stanford, and I was there with Harvard as a senior fellow. I taught indeed for 3.5 years at the City University of New York once a week until that just became too much, frankly, of a burden. On the board of the major cybersecurity services, pure play services firm in the world, support for think tanks engaged in venture capital.
So you haven't slowed down with investments
in 13 startups, several of them multiple times, and then support to well over a dozen veteran service organizations. So it's a busy, intellectually stimulating, I'd like to think productive and rewarding set of engagements, and I still get home for the family on most weekends.
Yeah, sounds like you've got a lot on your plate. If the president called, would you be interested in serving again?
Well, I mean, I was. We talked, obviously, about Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. Had a very good meeting with the president, at least based on the tweet, the generous tweet that he gave after that meeting. I can certainly understand why he might look at Rex Tillerson, the leader of the largest firm in the entire world, as an attractive partner for his administration. I have continued to provide advice and thoughts and so forth to a variety of members of the administration and those on Capitol Hill. And, you know, we'll see what the future might hold.
All right. Well, thanks, General Penn. Petraeus, thanks so much for talking with me.
Again, a pleasure to be with you.
Once more, I want to thank General David Petraeus for coming on the podcast and for his 37 years of service. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.